following episode contains language and descriptions of violence and self-harm. It may not be appropriate for all listeners, but it was my life. Discretion is advised.
I don't remember sleeping. I don't remember dating. I don't remember birthday parties. I don't remember anything but selling. We got into 43 distributors and 55,000 retail stores. And every day, all I did was sell. I was here in Arizona. I'd be at a car wash, and it was Danny's car wash. I remember it. And he had 17 car washes. I would go visit multiple of his car washes till I found Danny. And I would bring him my drinks every single time. And I'd go to the local restaurant. I would bring my drinks with me. I'd go to the nightclub. I'd bring my drinks with me. I'd wake up in the morning, gas station, my drinks were with me.
Wow.
No matter what, I was selling nonstop.
I'm your host, Peter Meyerhoff, and you're listening to the Roll Call with Chappie podcast. If you enjoy this show, please subscribe, share, and follow us on social media. You can learn more about this episode and my mission at petermeyerhoff.com. All right, drop it. Welcome back. I have not been this excited, no offense, Tommy Vex, for an episode on Roll Call today, but I have got an absolute, I don't even know how to describe you, an animal, beast, and one of the coolest dudes with the, I'd say one of the best reputations around. So Mr. Dan Fleischman in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
I am excited for this. I don't even know where to begin, and I usually do show notes and stuff and where I want to get the talks to go, but you have such an interesting, crazy story. I feel like this could go any direction. So I have no planning for this, and I just want to talk and shoot the shit with you.
Let's
so
go anywhere you want.
Let's go. I know about, and we're going to get into how you started making your money, but I want to know upbringing. How was your upbringing as a child?
So in high school, I was working three jobs simultaneously. I was at the stadium. Peanuts, Cracker Jacks here.
No way.
Rocking up and down the stairs selling peanuts. Working at Ruby's Diner with a sailor's cap on my head.
Wow.
And then working for a stockbroker under the table. And I was just saving up all my money because that was the only way I was going to pay for college was to save up my own money. And so that was my focus. I just wanted to work and save up money. And then when I was 17, I actually ended up doing a clothing brand, and I took the $43,000 I was going to spend on college on San Diego State University, and I spent it on my clothing brand. That's how it all kind of started.
Okay. And then the clothing brand is, for the people that don't know, is?
So I trademarked the catchphrase, "Who's your daddy?" for over 300 different products in 16 different countries. And clothing and energy drinks was the main ones. We did barbecue sets and different products with the name on it. And some names we took the name just to protect it so nobody else did it.
For sure.
Like sexual products, we didn't do Who's Your Daddy sexual products, but we didn't want other people to do it.
Gotcha.
But the t-shirts and hats and sweaters is what we crushed it on. That was our big thing.
How did you learn to do that? Like,
So my older brother and my partner's dad, they were the business guys that kind of gave us advice along the way when we were young whippersnappers trying to.
Yeah, that's what it's about, those asking people if you don't know. You know, the only stupid question is a question you don't ask. So you did that. And then let's get into after that. I think at 19 years old, you sold for.
So 18 years old, we did our first million. 19, we did 9.5 million in sales through Starter Apparel out in the UK. And then 23 years old, and we took it public. And that's when we launched the energy drink under the same name.
Youngest owner of a publicly traded company in history right here. Correct, at 23?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. I mean, I was watching podcasts on you, like every time I hear that, I'm just like, dude, how, you can't even fathom that, you know?
It's weird to think about because that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And even like thinking about the investment bankers and the lawyers and the accountants, it must have been weird because it was 2 years and $2 million of legal and accounting work to go public.
Really?
And so we actually started the process at 21. That was a lot of work and a lot of headache and a lot of everything to try to do it.
Even have the mindset to go public at 21 is just crazy, you know? Yeah.
We were thrown in the pool. It wasn't exactly our choice.
Yeah, for sure.
You got to swim.
Because I got a good friend that he actually owns, he got in the marijuana business and owns some dispensaries out here. And he was just learning everything as we go. And he ended up selling his whole operation for, I think, $180 million or so. But he had to pay like bankers and stuff. Like, I think it was $700,000-$800,000 to write up these contracts and stuff. And I was just like, it's kind of almost crazy to like figure out how much stuff behind the scenes there is. Because everybody says like going public, but you don't know how much work there is. And the fact that you could do that at 21 years old, I mean, that should show anybody they can do anything, you know?
Just your team, the people that are around you, they're the ones that can really do it. So I don't want to take credit for the hardest parts. It's a chief financial officer, accountants, lawyers, auditors, watching the lawyers. Like, there's a lot of moving parts and a lot of people involved to make it happen.
It's all about surrounding yourself with the right people, though, just like life is, right?
Yeah.
Cool. So what happens after that?
So 23, take it public. And then from 23 to 27, I actually don't remember anything but sales.
I heard you barely slept.
I don't remember sleeping. I don't remember dating. I don't remember birthday parties. I don't remember anything but selling. We got into 43 distributors and 55,000 retail stores. And every day, all I did was sell. I was here in Arizona. I'd be at a car wash, and it was Danny's car wash. I remember it. And he had 17 car washes. I would go visit multiple of his car washes till I found Danny. And I would bring him my drinks every single time. And I'd go to the local restaurant. I would bring my drinks with me. I'd go to the nightclub. I'd bring my drinks with me. I'd wake up in the morning, gas station, my drinks were with me.
Wow.
No matter what, I was selling nonstop.
That's like another level. So after that 4 years, then what do you do?
So 27 is now the 10-year anniversary. I started when I was 17. On the exact 10-year anniversary date, 5/22, I'll never forget, I wanted to put another feather in my cap, so I resigned. And I was like, you know, I want to start an online poker site. I love poker. Social media is just really getting started now. This is 2007,
yeah.
2008, 2009 range. And so I'm like, I want to do this. And so I literally put on a backpack and moved to a place called Malta.
Never heard of it.
Me neither.
I went Where there. Is it?
It's underneath the boot of Italy.
Okay.
And so I signed Dan Bilzerian, DJ Steve Aoki, Playboy Playmates, Sarah Underwood, all these interesting characters. This is pre-social media. This is like Twitter,
yeah,
Facebook, MySpace days, right? There's no Instagram. YouTube is just getting started. Like, and so I want to create a social media company that's going to go battle with these mega poker sites.
Yeah.
Major, humongous, $4 million a day, $8 million a day competitors. But I just went through that with energy drinks, right? I just battled 900 energy drinks. I battled Monster, Rockstar, Red Bull. I battled the 800-pound gorillas. Now I wanted to do it in poker. And so Bilzerian and Aoki and all these characters, they started to get quite famous on social, and they were doing TV, playing poker on TV. I was playing poker on TV. We had some big successes of some big victories on television, and ended up becoming the top 5 poker site out of the 550 in 10 months. And it sounds cool, except a year later, everything stopped. There's something called Black Friday, and I'll never forget it.
Okay.
Where essentially Bilzerian is actually the one that called me. He's like, hey, where are you? I'm like, I'm at the Bellagio. He's like, why aren't you in Malta? I was like, I'm here for a huge meeting at 12 o'clock. This is 10 a.m. At 12 o'clock, I'm meeting this billionaire guy that owns like the Wheel of Fortune, Jeopardy slot machines. He owns the licenses for that.
Wow.
He invented the card that you put into a slot machine.
Yeah.
You know, you see like
senior
citizens put that thing in.
Yeah, for sure. My nanny has one that she carries around with every day.
So this guy had sold it for like $440 million. He owns all these cool things. Like, I'm meeting the gambling legend. I flew in from another country to meet this guy. And so Bilzerian's like, you got to see, it's all over television. But I turn on TV and there it is. Online poker is shut down in America. I log into my site and I talk to my staff. We're not shut down. So my competitors got shut down by the FBI.
Wow.
Literally, it says FBI warning on their freaking website. If you go to PokerStars or Full Tilt, it said FBI, seized by the FBI. Mine didn't.
Hmm.
I was like, what the heck did they do? I'm calling around trying to figure out what did they do? What's happening? I go over to Hard Rock for my 12 o'clock meeting with this zillionaire guy. The second I walk in, he looks at me. He's like, man, you look like somebody died. I was like, no, it might be worse than that. Turn on the TV. They turned on the TV and he immediately calls Steve Wynn. And Steve Wynn is mad because like 11 days prior, he just announced his big deal with one of the poker sites that just got in trouble. And so it's like crazy mayhem. And anyways, so that like huge run that I had, this big poker site, and I'm about to do a big deal. I'm actually 4 days away from getting a big funding round at a $65 million valuation. And instead, over the next 4 days, I manually paid back 41,000 people. And I closed the poker site down.
And I heard too that you're one of the only people from this that had these sites that like paid all the people back like instantly, correct?
Yeah. So it took them both like 3 to 5 years to pay the players back. That was my fear. I wasn't sure what was the government going to do because they're slow and it's a lot of lawyers
and
involved.
They can do whatever they want.
Yes. I didn't want to get the knock on the door to get in trouble, even if I didn't do anything wrong, which I didn't do anything what they did, obviously, because what they did was involving merchant transactions. And anyways, too long of a story, but I didn't do anything what they did. I never even got a letter, so I was fine, but I want to sleep at night. And I wouldn't feel comfortable if the money got seized and the players didn't get their money back. So it was the biggest decision that to me was no decision.
For sure.
I'm going to pay every single person back and then I'll revisit it later. And so then for the next few years, it took off that poker was not going to come back regulated. And still a decade later, it's only regulated in 4 states, which is crazy. It's regulated in every other country on the planet. But that was my fear, is that the government would be slow. So luckily, I paid everyone back. The worst financial situation ended up becoming the best because it molded me into who I am.
Okay.
I'm never going to have all my eggs in one basket again.
There you go.
Right? I already had one main company, and then I had my second main company. I never did anything else. And this one just went away overnight.
Like that.
Doesn't matter if my competitors, the scoreboard's a scoreboard. It's my loss. It doesn't matter that I didn't do it. My loss.
Yeah.
Right. And so I never want to have that situation again. So I became an angel investor. So I started buying pieces of companies. I started a social media agency. That's my business, my job a decade later. So the bad things that happened literally forged who I am as a person.
Turned out to be blessings. And that's how anything in the world is too. Like, you know, you go through shit and it's like, there's certain things you go over and you feel like you're not going to get through them.
Right.
Especially me with all my prison time. I didn't know how I was going to get through it. And then once you get through it, it's all like, they're all learning lessons and they all put you on the path to where you're supposed to go anyways. You know what I mean? You just got, like I always say, you just got to fight through the tough times, you know?
You can't see it when you're in it.
For sure. Absolutely. And man, it's just kind of crazy to me because I feel like that would almost cripple my mindset into thinking like, why even start building other brands? Because you still probably had enough money to go run away and hide forever, right?
In that moment, you have a choice.
Yeah.
I always say I could sit on the floor and cry about it, which rightfully so, I could have sat and cried.
That was probably a pretty good choice at that time too, right?
just lost a $65 million company.
Yeah.
I'm 4 days away from flying to Costa Rica with Playboy Playmates and do photo shoots. And like, I'm behind a computer screen. I cancel all the flights and hotels for all the girls.
Oh.
I'm not doing a photo shoot. I'm not getting an investor. I'm not building my business. I'm not scaling my company. I'm manually paying people back now. It's hard.
Yeah.
Try doing that 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah. How'd you even do it?
Exactly.
I was
sending carrier pigeons to figure out.
Right.
Anyways. And so that moment, you just have a choice. You can sit on the floor and cry and be miserable for weeks or months or years and get depressed, or I consume myself with work. I was doing news interviews and like explaining to people what to do. I started taking consulting gigs and I consulted for 4 land-based casinos. I just turned my business tragedy into the rest of my life.
There you go. And that's what I always talk about, switching addictions. You know what I'm saying? I switched from a drug addiction stuff to just a money addiction, you know, and just like wanted to like be hungry and learn everything I can, make as much money as possible, you know, and then the money didn't motivate me anymore. Now, like I'm on a mission to help people, you know? Yeah. One thing I do want to get into with you is like social media stuff, because you are a social media guru and I don't even know where to start, but I'm so mad at myself because when I got out of prison, I didn't believe in social media. Like I'll tell you, when my first day out of prison, I went golfing and we got done golfing with, there was an eightsome, two foursomes there. I go use the restroom. I'm back. There were 7 all dudes, every single one of them was sitting on their phone. And I could not fathom that every single one of these guys was sitting on their phone. I wouldn't even text message at first, like no joke. I didn't do Instagram until the last couple of years. And then I saw all these dudes just getting rich off social media. And I'm like, what the hell am I waiting on? You know? So how did you get into starting the social media thing? And then, cause I feel like you're almost on the next level. There's people that need the social media to build their brands. You're the next level to where like, you don't even need social media. I heard an interview say you're kind of trying to do social media for yourself now, but like, you don't even need it. What made you get into it then?
So I was utilizing it for the brands that I was investing in.
Okay.
So I was buying 50K, 100K, 200K of a business. And then some of those businesses would then ask me for help on social media or just say, hey, we need marketing. What should we do? And so I'm like, oh, you should work with this girl, or hey, you should work with these 4 guys, or hey, this band would do it for you. And they'll tweet about you or they'll post about you on Facebook, whatever. And so I was doing these things. Then one of the brands was like, okay, we're going to wire you 100,000. I'm like, don't wire it to me. I don't have a company. They're like, no, but you do it. We don't know how to do it. I'm like, yeah, no, but don't wire it to me personally. That doesn't make any sense. That's not what I do. And so I made a company called One Penny Ad Agency. And it's basically like, you'll get 1 penny per 1,000 eyeballs. And it was just making an insinuation of like 1 penny per eyeball would make people realize how cheap it is to get content on social media compared to billboards, TV, radio, et cetera.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Where it's $20 to $40 CPM rate, which is cost per 1,000. This is like $1 to $4 cost per 1,000. And so people started wiring 25K, 50K, 100K, 250K, 500K, 100K, 100K. I'm like, and because it was the Wild Wild West.
Yeah.
Right? It's still confusing now, but again, remember it 8 years ago.
Yeah.
People had no idea. And so we were doing tweets and I was driving Fashion Nova dresses over to the Kardashians' houses and fit tea bags for Kim to hold on a kitchen counter. And why should the caption say that? You know, like it was the Wild Wild West.
Wow.
And so just getting thrown into the fact that Fashion Novas and Fit Tees and Sugar Bear Hair and all these brands were getting started. And they were luckily my clients at the beginning. I was getting to learn in real time and then learn at the biggest level, because then Fit Tees like, hey, spend $1 million. Hey, Sugar Bear's like, hey, spend $1.6 million. Fashion Nova's like, hey, spend $2 million for me. And then it gets interesting, right? Because now you're learning at scale.
For sure.
And so as an agency, I've got to learn spending money for these brands. for the companies I was investing into and for my clients.
And it's probably easier too, because now that I'm just thinking about it, like billboard sales, you don't know how much they're getting the billboard or how much the people just saw another ad or something like that. There you can like legit track real time how it's working, because whether they're putting the codes on their stories or whatever the case may be, you can almost find out exactly how good the influencers work and how much sales you're making off just a direct post right there, right? So that would that make it easier to sell the next time?
Yeah, so you have screenshots and analytics of everything.
Yeah.
I can see how many views, what country the views are from, male or female, what time of day do they post. There's no wondering or guessing if someone watches a TV commercial or a radio commercial. That's hard. I don't know if you saw it.
For sure.
I don't know if she saw it, he saw it, she saw it, because it says 100,000 people are watching. Are they looking at their phone? Did they fast forward? Did they go to the restroom? Are they eating snacks? I don't know if they actually saw
it. That's what I do on commercials.
Exactly. We do all of those things during commercials. But the thing you don't do is watch commercials.
Yeah.
Right? On social, we know how many people liked it, how many people commented, how many people forwarded it to their friends, how many people saved it. I can see all the different things that happen. It's not just the views. I can see all the other interactions that happen on a post, on a video, or a photo. That's really useful for a brand to see. What do people do? Let's say First Forum has a photo. In that photo, influencer posted, let's say you're posting it, right? And you get 46 comments this time. But then you post it a different way and you're splashing the protein powder on you, right? You take something funny happens and you've got 460 comments. And then the next time you do it, you're posting in the gym and you get 182 comments. And the next time you do it, you take it and you're like, hey, I'm about to go running. And you get 22 comments. We can see, do people care about the running? Did they care about the gym? Did they like the comedy one? What did they like and why?
Gotcha.
And then how many people did they forward it to? Did they save it? What did they do with it? A lot of things can be learned from the type of content as well.
For sure. Wow. Guys, that's so genius. So the Kardashians and stuff, how did you get in with them, with your company? Because, I mean, for a lot of people that are thinking, you know, there's certain guys on Instagram, like I DM a lot of people, certain dudes that are, you know, Andy Frisella is one. He's never saw any of my stuff. I know he's talked about me, but like he's never saw any of my Instagram stuff. How did you get in with the Kardashians and people that know the Kardashians through Instagram and stuff like that when you didn't have the Instagram name already yourself?
So I just paid them. Similar to whether you're trying to get a hold of someone like an Andy Frisella or you're trying to get a hold of a Kardashian, there's some people when they're worth hundreds of millions of dollars, you have to pay to be in the room. And so when Kris Jenner finds out I want to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars with her daughters and effectively millions of dollars with her daughters, I've spent $18 million now. If I say, hey, I want to spend $1.5 million with all five of the girls, I'm going to pay them $250,000 each, blah, 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 and I'm going to give you $250,000 to do posts for this, this, and this, I get to come over in the living room and then have dinner with them, right?
For sure.
Because I'm paying to be in the room. So I don't want to say it's like, oh, Dan's so nice. Yeah. You should just go get to meet the most famous family in history. I paid to be in the room. But I had it come from different angles. So sometimes you might want to get a hold of an influencer or celebrity. You can interact with their best friend, their brother,
that was my next point.
Staff member, their assistant, their business partner, blah, blah, blah. There's people that are around them that are professional best friends, people that are part of their social circle that have their ear. They're the ones that are gonna be like, hey, have you seen this brand? Hey, have you seen this person? Have you heard about this podcast? Hey, have you heard of this thing? They'll do it for you. They'll do the talking for you. And so in that scenario, like the Kardashians, I had a dear friend of mine, his name was Brandon Kaplan. He's the one that actually got me in the door, like, emotionally with them, because he's so close with the family.
Okay.
For so many years, he grew up with them, where they already knew about me. They knew about the brand. They knew about the products. They knew I was doing fashion and tea. They knew like all the things that were happening, but emotionally, he's the one that set up the meeting and said, hey, Kris, not only is he going to pay, but he's a trusted guy. I've been friends with him for years. And Brandon drove me over there.
Wow. That's cool. That's a perfect point. Cause that's what I always say too. There's like stepping stones. You know what I mean? You can't just like shoot and DM the guy with 2 million followers, something like that. And I do the same thing. You got to literally work your way up. And I've done that myself single-heartedly. And I, to be honest, I got a little discouraged. I watched one of your interviews yesterday and people were asking if you can, like in 2022, can you build an Instagram without paying money? And you're like, without collabing, it's nearly impossible. And I feel like I'm so hard-headed. I've been trying to do this by myself the entire time. Like literally, you know, I got over 10,000 followers now and I try to do the post and it does get tiresome. The collabing, I feel like helps a ton though, but it's like, I've been almost trying to do this myself and it does get discouraged, you know, because sometimes you'll lose followers and you gain them and it's like you do the same thing like repetitiously day in and day out and it's just like such a slow, slow climb. So do you agree then that it's almost impossible to grow a social media without paying money now if you're not collabing with big time people?
So 10,000 functional followers is more useful than 100,000 random followers. Collabing is what you're doing right this second. This is a collab.
Yep.
So podcasts are a very functional way for you to gain following because, let's say I repost your content, my audience is then by default going to see the content and know that it's a trusted person, right?
For sure.
The collaboration would be you and the gym, right? If you and some football players and you and some first form athletes or you and some friends are working on the gym and making content, their following, whether it's 40,000 or 400,000, is more inclined to like you because they also like to follow someone that already works out.
Yes.
So if they're making fitness content with you in the gym, they're inclined to want to follow you. That's a collaboration. So you have business collaborations. You can have charity collaborations where you and a bunch of people go deal with the sobriety situation or deal with the homelessness or deal with et cetera. You can have the athletes. You can have it. Collaborations can be with your friends where it's literally just you and your buddies making content together, doing business content like this. You want to hit different angles because you don't know which pocket of followers fit you.
For sure.
You don't know if it's the athletes that are going to love you. You don't know if it's going to be your fitness friends that love you. You don't know if it's going to be the business followers that love you. You don't know. You want each of those type of circles to be watching you and seeing you. But what happens the most is someone follows multiple of that. Someone follows you and Tommy Vex, and then they see you also in a business podcast, and then they see you doing with a charity thing. Like not that. Only are they your follower, but now they're in it.
Yeah, right.
They they're going to share you, tag you, etc. And so the number is not as important. The 10,000 versus 50,000 versus 200,000, it is seriously just a benchmark in people's minds. It's a good goal number to keep focusing on. But you gaining 1,100 people that are Tommy's followers and then 400 people that are mine and 4,000 that are this and blah, 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 that's going to add up way more than you just doing a big growth campaign and getting 100,000 followers. It's useless.
Absolutely. I agree because, you know, I do a lot of content and videos and stuff like that. And, you know, I noticed more than anything, just when I met you in Utah and I took that picture of you and Sean Whalen and I did bet the Bull Evans or something like that, like, dude, each day I was just getting tons of followers and I wasn't even doing content just because you guys were on my story, you know? And that's another thing I like to talk about too, is because your crew is always kind of have the same kind of missions and goals in life. You know what I mean? So their followers should almost be for the most part what your followers are thinking, right? Too. So if you're hanging the right clicks, if my followers like what all Tommy Vex is doing, they should pretty much like what I'm doing. You know what I mean? We both are into the same stuff. We're both sober. We're both into fitness, like music, you know, and like America and want to save the world and help people, you know? So they should transit over there. So, which gets me to another point of yours. Out of everything you've done, I think it's probably one of the coolest things that I got from your podcast. And I feel like your number one mission now is you just want to help people and save the world. So Can we get into, I know you have a charity about backpacks. I want to get you talking about that and then we'll get into some more stuff about that.
So my main charity has been 10 years now. It's called Model Citizen Fund. We make backpacks for the homeless with 150 items inside. Half of it's food and drinks. The other half is like cleaning supplies, a poncho, a watch, hat, sleeping bag, etc. And that charity I'm going to do for the rest of my life. We do it for women abuse shelters, teen abuse shelters and orphanages, and mostly for homeless shelters. Outside of that, I throw a lot of charity events throughout the year. So I've thrown for the last 8 years, I do a back to school drive, where obviously we get back to school supplies for all the kids. We have 400 families show up in person, and then we give all the extras to more families outside of the 400 that come in person, 400 families. We do a report card day where kids will bring their report cards. They got an A, like, oh, you get a big prize. We got a B, like, oh, we got you a good prize. They're like, we have a C, give you okay,
high
you know,
five.
Yeah, we want you to do better, but here's all your general school supplies. Then we do a Thanksgiving food drive. That's obvious what we do there. And then we do our big one is our toy drive.
Okay.
This December, we did a SoFi Stadium. We've covered the entire field with tens of thousands of toys.
I saw it. So what, and then what is it that makes you want to help people? Because there's a ton of people, you know, I listen to you talking about this. There's so much money in the world that like we could fix all the world issues just about for the most part. What is it that makes you different than the rest from not wanting to, I mean, because you could just sit in a huge multi-million dollar gated property doing whatever you want every day and you don't have to help out with anybody. But what is it that makes you want to help people?
There's so many emotional aspects to it. One is I know it's fixable. And so from a game perspective, everything I do in my life's a game. The money part's a game. I don't buy stuff, right? I've had the same watch for 13 years. I haven't owned a car in 7 years.
Like, I love that.
I don't buy stuff, right? I invest in companies and I do my charity stuff. So to me, it's a game. The business part is a game. That's why I'm so active on all this stuff. But the three things that humans need, food, water, and shelter, that's very curable. Especially with the bazillions of dollars that are supposedly donated every year, really curable.
Mm-hmm.
I have very basic ways that we can fix it.
Yeah.
And so it's frustrating to me that it doesn't get fixed, and I won't depend on the government to do it because there's a lot of red tape and they're very slow. And so I need to get as rich as possible. I need to become a multi-billionaire, literally to fix problems and to bring my friends. I need them to get richer too. That's why I always push so many friends and followers to invest in things and get richer. I need them to get richer. I need them to help me as well, because a few billion is not going to fix it. I need lots of people and lots of things. But I have figured out very simple ways of how we can cure food, water, and shelter. And my goal is to do as many of those things as I can before I pass away. But most importantly, put in the stepping blocks of how other people can replicate it and do that long after I'm gone. And so that's it. That's my mission. I know that I can fix those things. The homeless backpacks is practice for me. Right, I'm doing it forever, but it's just to get me in the door. So I'm good with municipalities and cities and officials. And I understand how to deal with when you're shipping overseas, emergency supplies. Like, it's been practice for the last 10 years.
For sure.
Throwing charity events, getting everyone aware of me on the charity side. But it's for the ultimate version of food, because that is the most curable situation, especially with the bazillions of dollars that restaurants and grocery stores throw away every day. Not every year, every day.
Yeah.
That is one part of it, but also how little people actually need to survive on the food side of things, and how solvable it is to send them small amounts of food that is healthy for them. I see so many mega conglomerates that could pitch in, that could fix it fast.
Literally.
On the water side, there are some good charity ones like Charity Water that have a good mission, but they need a lot more money to do what they're doing. There's a lot of new technologies that are coming out that it can actually make water like from the oxygen.
Really?
Yeah, it's crazy stuff. And they can make clean water from like really bad water.
Uh-huh.
Those are what will take to fix the water situations in like Africa, Mexico, Canada, wow, etc. But ultimately, shelter is what people really, 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 really need, because the food and water part is very inexpensive. Shelter is not. That's the part that takes a huge amount of capital.
And you had some ideas for that, though, right? Weren't you going to look like what your end goal? Don't you want to do? Or...
My central concept is to replicate jails.
Okay, I'm familiar with those.
Yeah. And so imagine a jail that's not technically a jail. The homeless person could come and go as long as they're leaving for work and leaving for family. Like they're not in jail, so they're not stuck there, but they're there for their own good and for the good of society, because it's very expensive for them to not be inside.
For sure.
Very expensive for homeless people to be outside. And I know it sounds weird. Like, why is it expensive? There's constant security. There's constant cleanup. There's constant feces. There's a lot of bad things medical that happen.
Stuff, yeah.
Crime happens. Medical situations happen, etc. And so creating effectively jails that are not jails, especially in the outskirts, like of outskirts of cities, a lot of jails are right on the freeway, which I never understood.
Yeah.
And broad daylight right by the freeway, it's really strange to me, because there's a lot cheaper, better real estate just 5-10 miles away. But the homeless people learning, eating, and being around an environment where they're safe and not having drugs in their system would change our entire planet.
And one thing I've learned too, and which is why, like, I go with my biggest thing is like the recidivism rate, helping inmates when they get out, is because, like, I feel like once those guys that have had like their backs up against the wall, like no other chances, once you can like spark a little flame under them, and whether it's a backpack or something, it just gives them a little bit of hope. Like, once you can light that switch on them, a lot of those guys are unstoppable. Like for myself, man, after, you know, I overdosed and I got out of prison, I was dead, brought back to life. And then like literally a light flicked into my head and I was like, dude, I'm going to do this. I'm done making excuses. Like, so that's one of the biggest reasons I help a ton of people now, is because I love seeing those lights go off. You know what I mean? And we talked about, I want to shout out another really cool nonprofit. It's the Sister Mary House out there in LA, you know, and I had met them just doing some charity work out of prison. And these dudes, if you want to talk about gratitude, I met them in a room and they're all were doing either life sentences, multiple life sentences, some are on death row, and they change their lives in prison, give their life to God. And they correspond with this Sister Mary, who's literally an angel. And she goes there and visits them. She speaks on their parole boards, and she gets these guys out of prison, and then they all come in there and work for her. I was there when I think there was 9 or 10 dudes. The shortest dude had done 19 years straight, 33 straight. And there's 3 guys that did over 40 plus years straight, and they come out and they're the nicest human beings. All they want to do is help. And what do? They literally are doing charity work the second they get out of prison. So that's like one of the greatest passions in life, because when you can help other people and see the light click off, not only is it making you feel grateful for your life, but it also gets you out of your own head and makes you not feel like you got it so bad. Cause I mean, I have an awesome life right now, but I could still wake up tomorrow and think, fuck it. You know what I mean? This sucks. Or have one bad morning and let it ruin my whole day. So helping people takes a ton of gratitude for me, and it just puts it to the next level. So I would definitely love to do some stuff with you and Sister Mary's house in LA if we ever could. But next plans, what are your goals for the next 5 or 10 years? Because I think people can learn a ton from actually setting goals. So what are goals like for a guy like you?
So I always say I want to save the world. This is a very lofty goal.
I love it. Seriously. I got goosebumps when you said that on your podcast last night. I was like, wow.
But it's real. Like, I have clear visions of ways to save the world, and none of it's for me. I don't want a pat on the back to do it. I want to do the thing so that people replicate what I do. And they can adjust it for themselves or pick and choose. But if I can make backpacks for the homeless, you don't need my backpack. You can make your own backpack. You can fill up Ziploc bags. You can put it in a garbage bag, a laundry bag. I don't care. Yeah. You can replicate what I'm doing in your own fashion, your own version, duffel bags, whatever. I want you to see what I'm doing and see how effective it is, and then make your own version or copy it exactly. I don't need you to donate to me. If I do a Thanksgiving food drive, you don't need to donate to my Thanksgiving food drive, right? I want you to do Thanksgiving food drives in Philadelphia, New York, Miami, Uzbekistan, Albuquerque, New Mexico, wherever the heck you are on the planet.
That place you live, Mala, what is it?
Malta, whatever. Malta, like, yeah. I want you to do your own Thanksgiving food drive. You don't need money to do it. You need the community. You need to invite people. You need to get energy behind it. And so I'm constantly posting about charity, my Save the World, because I want to show people, whether it's toy drives, food drives, homelessness, whatever, these are things that don't take money to do. I'm spending money to make them bigger.
For sure.
Completely unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
You could do it as a 15-year-old kid without a cell phone if you wanted to. It's more useful if you were 18 years old, had a cell phone and a passion mission, but you don't actually need any money. You just need energy. You need to rally people behind you. And so I keep wanting to showcase to the world how you can do charity, the realistic ways to do it, how effective it is. And I'm very clear about the whole time, not about donating to me or my charity or whatever charity I'm helping. It's for you guys to do this in your cities.
Wow. You're a remarkable man. So let me hear, what is a crazy goal you have besides the charities for the next 5 or 10 years? Are you strictly just trying to save the world right now? Do you have any other business goals on top of that? Or are you just kind of living off their investments?
I've been investing really aggressively this last year. We've deployed $27 million in the last 5 months. We're averaging $2 to $6 million per investment. And I'm really streamlining that. So I have a syndicate group called Elevator Syndicate. There's 648 members in the group right now that are all strategic investors. And so I want to streamline that at some point to be able to do one a week. We're like, right now I'm doing around 1 to 2 a month.
Yeah.
I want to end up doing one a week, where basically, like, on a weekend I'll post about, like, hey, I'm investing into this new Icon Meals or this new pizza company or this new whatever, and post about it on the weekend. And then Monday people sign and wire. Right now it's happening. We're funding deals in like 7 to 14 days. And it's really fast and effective for the founder, for the company. But I believe at scale, if I can do 2 to 6, I don't need to do $20 million, $50 million rounds. $2 to $6 million, the perfect size, finding companies that are doing $2 to $20 million in sales that I can really help, and then bringing in a bunch of really smart strategic investors to invest into that company, that's going to create thousands and thousands of jobs. It already has.
Yeah.
The 37 investments I've done have created tens of thousands of jobs. So like, the investing to me is also part of my save the world part, like my feel good, because creating jobs is way more than giving out money. Way more. I can go give someone $5,000 and they're going to be broke in 2 or 3 months, right?
Or 2 weeks.
Right?
Yeah.
But if I give them a job making $2,400 a month, well, now they can build a life from that, right? Not to say that's going to be their job forever. But that doesn't just affect them. That affects their family, their friends, the community, the way that they spend money at the local liquor store, the local clothing store, the local masseuse, the local pharmacy.
Yeah.
It's the butterfly effect of what happens from that person making $2,400, $3,000 a month, $4,000 a month, $5,000 a month, $10,000 a month, et cetera. That's what's really interesting to me. I want to do that at scale. So if I can just keep investing in more and more companies and finding founders early, I believe we can create hopefully millions of jobs.
Wow, that's so true. Another random question here is, because me and Hannah deal with this quite a bit, how does Casey live with how much you are all over the place? everybody I talked to, like, oh, that Dan, he's in another state every other day. How do you, if you don't mind me asking, how do you balance the home life and stuff with Casey? Does she travel with you a lot, or how is she cool with you just being on your mission right now?
So if I go for 3 days or more, then she comes with me.
Okay.
Optionally, she doesn't have to go.
For sure.
Certain cities, she's like, I'm not going there for three days or 4 days. But for the most part, if I'm going somewhere for 3 or 4 days, she'll go with me. When I'm going into cities, I mostly do what I call ninja trips. I'm there for one day.
Like today. Yeah.
I flew in at 9 a.m. I'm leaving at 5 p.m.
Yeah.
Right. And when I leave here, I'm stacking my days. I speak an event. I come see you for a podcast. And then at 3:30, I have a bunch of business guys meet me for lunch. So I can see everyone. And then boom, 5 o'clock, I'm fly out.
Yeah.
And then when I get there, him and I are going to a meeting. We're going to, like, it's all stacked.
Yeah, for sure.
For the most part, if I can avoid sleeping over, I don't even sleep over just to get back to her.
Gotcha, that's cool.
So I'll take the last flight out. I'll take a 7, 8, or 9 o'clock flight just to get back so I fall asleep at home next to her.
There you go.
If it's a sleepover, because I have to do my thing at 9 a.m. or 7 a.m. in a different city, then obviously I'm going to stay the night. And then whenever I can, I'm flying back. But it's really rare that I go on a business trip where I don't come back within one day.
Gotcha.
So like I'm going to be gone for 24 to 32 hours. Like I'm going to, if I leave Monday morning, I'm coming back by Tuesday night. It's really rare that I'm going to stay for more than one day. And most of the time, because most of my stuff is West Coast or Dallas, most of that I'm going to go back and forth in the same day, which is tiring. And oftentimes she's like, you don't need to fly back tonight. It's fine.
Yeah.
I just do it. It's like I don't want to get used to it.
For sure.
And so I make myself fly back the same night. Like, of course, if I fly to Vegas, I want to stay the night, right? I want to gamble, play poker, go to dinner. That dinner's there, start late. Almost all the time, I fly back the same night because it's easy for me to just stay there. It's easy for me to stay late in Phoenix or whatever. And so for the most part, I just fly back. And communication. I'm texting with her nonstop.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, she doesn't care. Like, I don't need to update her.
Yeah.
But again, I want to do it. It's practice for me. Like, yeah. I'm doing it because I don't want to ever get complacent with the fact that she's so cool with me traveling like a madman.
I don't want to take advantage of it.
Yeah. I don't want to get complacent with it ever.
Yeah, for sure. That's a good point. Another little piece of advice I want to give to people too is, you know, we both talk about networking. I was telling you in the garage, you know, when I got out of prison, I was pulling dudes' numbers from the gym. I would talk to dudes everywhere I go because I had zero connections, no education, no idea how to be successful. All I knew when I got out of prison that I had to be sober and I wanted like the cool big body S-class and I wanted to drive a nice car, but I didn't have any idea how to get it. And me and you met in Salt Lake City, Utah. Happened to be at I think it was clearly a God thing because that was the only night we went out to dinner actually the entire trip. And we go to this nice steakhouse, and of course, you and Sean Whalen are at the table sitting right next to us. And shout out to Ian Went. I was with Ian Went too. And to talk about approaching people, you know, like what I wanted to do was go to your table, like, oh my God, Sean Whalen and Dan Fleisch, what up? But what do? We wait till you guys are done eating. And then, like, I just try to get, well, I don't even know if it was 45 seconds just to try and give you a little bit of a spiel and like try to just tell you my story and get you to do my podcast. But I waited till you guys were done with dinner and then walked out of the restaurant real quick. Bugged you for a picture, of course, real quick. But that's how you're here. And then literally 2 weeks later, I go from Dan Fleischman, like the legend, like I don't even know what words to describe it, but that's how I looked at you on Instagram and stuff too. I run into you in Utah and then you're at my house in my studio 2 weeks later, you know? So it shows anything's possible. If you want to go get to somebody, go get them. You know what I mean? Do you have any more advice on stuff like that? Or
so there's a combination of things that if you break that down.
Yeah.
One, there's a God involved because the timing of that, I wasn't supposed to be at that restaurant. Sean and I were not planning to have dinner at that place. We were staying somewhere else. And Roger was actually booking dinner somewhere else.
Wow.
And it happened to be that we came there. And that restaurant was booked.
So like a month or two out.
Yeah. So the fact that we were sitting table to table with each other was also very interesting. So there's the luck factor, but you have to put yourself in a position to get lucky.
And absolutely.
The fact that you were out at dinner with Ian Wentz and that whole crew, the fact that you were taking action, put yourself in a position for that situation that caused the butterfly effect of me now sitting in this chair.
Yeah.
Right. And then I post content and then, Andy sees it. And then this happens. Like, you don't know what happens.
Who
right?
knows what's
the butterfly
happen.
Effect happens. You don't know.
Yeah.
But if you were at home playing video games and you're not at the dinner with Ian, then we're not here.
Absolutely.
And then the situation with Andy, the butterfly effect 2 weeks from now doesn't happen.
There is none.
Doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And so one part is you got to be in the room. Right. Now, once you're there, you have decisions to make. You can be a fly on the wall and be nervous and be on your phone. And then I could have been at the table next to you and I got up and I left.
And I didn't even see.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And then life moves on and we never happen. This doesn't happen. So you have to make a decision for yourself. Is your future worth more than your uncomfortability?
Yeah.
Because it's easy for you. It's easier for you to just keep eating your steak than get up and say hi.
I lost my appetite. I'm serious. Like, I'm not joking. When I saw you guys there the entire time, I told Hannah everything. Like, I didn't even care about, I was like, just give me water. I don't care about food or anything. Like, all I was doing is waiting to make sure that I was like looking out, not trying to be creepy, but looking out the corner of my eye to make sure when you guys left. Cause I was like, I knew what my mission was. And the second I saw you guys, I was like, dude, this is a God thing right here. Cause we had dinner plans to go out every single night there too. And that, it's funny. Like I said, that was the only night we ended up going out to dinner. And I run into you guys too, which is just absolutely crazy. So if that doesn't inspire you guys to do whatever you can, I don't know what will. So one other thing I want, can you give, and this might be a hard question to ask, but like, whether it's a youngster in high school that wants to do more or someone that's just like working a dead end job that knows that they're built for more or made for more, people that are stuck in shitty situations but don't know how to get out, can you give any advice for somebody on how to even just take the first step to get out of the situation or how to be the next Dan Fleischman or something like that? You know, I mean, I want to hear this myself as well.
There's a couple things. If you're a youngster, the first thing you can do is to go work for someone for free or for cheap that you look up to.
For sure.
And there's, every city has like the local legends, the local ballers, the guy that owns 6 car dealerships, the lady that owns 200 properties, the person that has 16 cupcake shops or the 52 restaurants. Like every city has those people, those characters that kind of like the main movers and shakers in town. Going to work for them for free is not free. It's training camp.
For sure.
It's literally like training camp. You people around the planet, which is strange to me, pay $30,000 to $100,000, $50,000 a year for college, right? And that's normal. Normal for us to tell 18-year-olds to go pay $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 for college.
Yeah.
But when I tell people to go work for free for Damon John because they like clothing, I'm looked at like, oh, how could you do that? You're not getting paid what you're worth. Wait, but you're going to pay $40,000 to UC Irvine College?
Yeah.
To teachers that...
To make 75, 80 grand a year. Yeah.
So you're willing to pay 40 grand to... for a year to be there, but you're not willing to go and not pay any money to go work directly for a guy that built a $1 billion clothing brand because you like clothing. You want to study clothing at UC Irvine, but you won't pay.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
For sure.
It's fascinating to me, the mindset, because that's what we grew up as. That's normal. Paying 30 grand for college is normal. Going to work for Damon John to learn about clothing is not normal because you're not getting paid what you're worth.
Yeah.
So you don't have to be youngster to go do that. You could also be 47, just fresh out of jail and going to go.
Yeah, 37 like mine.
Go work there. The same concept applies. But working for someone in the game or you aspire to be. So if you want to be the biggest real estate agent in LA, go work for the biggest real estate agent. Absolutely. You want to be the best insurance person in Alabama, go work for an insurance agency. Literally, just go work and watch them. How do they interact with their secretary? When do they take their lunches? When do they show up and leave? Mm-hmm. Who are they meeting with? How long are they on phone calls? Are they short phone calls or are they long phone calls? Who are they? Are they texting all the time? Are they on social much? Just watch. You're in the room and do what you can to make their life easier. Time and efficiency.
Yes.
If you do that, they are going to pay you. They're not going to want you to leave.
Yeah.
Because for sure. The most valuable thing you can give to someone that's busy or rich is time.
Yes.
And so if you're in the room and you're learning from them, watching them, and you're seeing how the staff interacts and how they do their marketing campaigns, how are their paid ads? How do they interact with bad problems and lawsuits? Everything. You want to know the good, the bad, and the ugly. Because if you want to be that person one day, watch them.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing is, outside of all that, you can consume so much from the people that you look up to for free.
Yep.
There's no category from how to bury people and embalm people, mortuaries, to how to run a bowling alley.
Yeah.
To be a pediatrician. To create anything on the planet. There's nothing that you can't Google or YouTube watch. Nothing. From as creepy as mortuaries to as random as bowling alleys. Nothing.
For sure.
And so just consuming content at nighttime, so it doesn't affect your work, doesn't affect your school. Don't tell me you don't have time because you watch Netflix. Don't tell me you don't have time. Watch a couple hours a night learning about how to run a mortuary or a bowling alley or nail salon, pediatrician, whatever. If you watch a couple hours a night, that means you're going to end up watching thousands of hours a year. Don't you think you're going to get pretty smart if you watch thousands of hours a year? That's way more than you do in college or high school.
Yeah.
And so you can learn a ton about what category you want to be in, especially from the people that are at the top of the space.
Mm-hmm. And you got to watch, you know, I'm an open book, but I asked Bradley's, you know, when I got out and I started making money really quick, not Fleisch money, but, you know, like a few hundred grand a year. And I instantly blew past all my friends that went to college and stuff. So I didn't even know who to get advice from or how to take the next step. And I'm open about all. I studied people on Instagram. You know, I studied you guys, Frisella, Bradley. Like, I'd watch the stories every day and like literally studied them and like picked their words apart. And that's, you know, I got taught how to do this just from watching guys' Instagram stories. You know right. what I mean? And you can use that. Everybody has all the tools they want right there in their hand. You know what I mean? If you just choose to put the work in, you can do anything in the damn world you want to.
Everything you want is in your phone. It's free. You just got to take the action.
Absolutely. It's all about taking action. So thank you for being here. I know your time is more than valuable. Private jet waiting for you after this. So we'll get you back here. And like I said, just thank you again. You brought a lot of inspiration to not only myself, but all the audience here awesome. Too. So I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast and leave us some feedback. We would love to know what you think. You can find everything discussed in this episode and more in our show notes below or petermeyerhoff.com. I am Peter Meyerhoff, and you've been listening to the Roll Call with Chappie podcast.